Issues Etc. returned to the air after being canceled by the previous leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod during Holy Week of 2008. For a special 10-year anniversary donation of $100 or more, we'll send you a CD of Issues Etc. listeners' top 12 hymns. You can make an anniversary gift online at issuesetc.org or by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
I didn't march 1 yard, 1 foot for the same sex to get married, and they're taking wrong and making it right, and taking right, making it wrong.
Those of us who are inspired by Judeo-Christian values, we're not seeking to sit in judgment of anyone, but we know that there are fundamental truths proven through thousands of years of human history.
I've referred to Joel Osteen's theology of the tyranny of positive thinking, where everybody must say positive things and think positive thoughts in order to be blessed by God.
That's the difference between preaching about Christ, where you basically just cut them apart and use them however you see fit, versus preaching Christ.
Pro Football Hall of Fame wives, love Issues, etc.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Maybe the most famous words from the American Declaration of Independence, and now that we have flipped the calendar page over to July, the thoughts of Americans turn to these words, words that make a reference to God, the Creator. What does that reference to a Creator mean, though? In a document designed to explain the reasons for revolution. That and more will be our first hour today on Issues, Etc. Hi, I'm Ken Sherb, sitting in for Todd Wilkin. Todd, by the way, is speaking at a Lutheran youth retreat in Florida. Yeah, I know, it's rough work. We'll all volunteer for it next July about this time. Anyway, it's Tuesday, July 1st. We're coming to you live. Our telephone number, 1-877-623-MY-IE. That's 1-877-623-MY-IE. That's 623-6943. You can send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or you can send us a tweet at Issues ETC. Let's give you the lineup here. Our guest for our first hour to talk about the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution is Dr. Mark Kaltoff from Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. We'll get to him in just a moment. Then, in the second hour, about an hour from now, maybe you heard about the big Hobby Lobby case decision handed down by the Supreme Court yesterday. We're going to be talking about that Supreme Court ruling against the Health and Human Services contraception mandate, at least in some respects, with none other than Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We'll have him on for the first whole quarter of the hour or so. And then we'll spend the rest of the hour talking about a kind of a belated birthday celebration. I think it was Friday that was the birthday of Francis Pieper, a theologian, a seminary president, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We'll have Dr. John Wohlrabi, who is a historian and currently the second vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, with us for the rest of the 4 o'clock hour to talk about Francis Pieper. You're invited to join us at any time. Once again, our telephone number, 1-877-623-MY-IE. Dr. Mark Kaltoff is a professor of history and chairman of the Department of History at Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. Dr. Kaltoff, I know you're no stranger to these microphones. It's the first time I think you and I have had a chance to talk. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Ken. It's a delight to be part of the conversation.
I know, and I think a lot of folks here in this part of the country know your uncle, I guess, Jim.
That's right. He's a relative of my own father, a great uncle, I believe, and we Kaltoffs come from western Missouri, Kansas City area, a lot of good German stock farmers of Lutheran Church Missouri Synod heritage.
Well, we're glad to have you here to talk about really a timely subject, because it is today, July 1st. Now, John Adams said that the day that he had in mind was going to be celebrated, and he predicted it with some uncanny accuracy, with fireworks and picnics and celebrations and all kind of fall-de-rall, the grand and glorious 2nd of July. How come he was talking about the second, and how come the fourth gets so much attention in just those ways?
Excellent question. Actually, Adams, as many people know, carried on a vigorous correspondence with his wife, Abigail, and the 2nd of July was indeed the important day. It really, if we were a nation of antiquarians, we would be celebrating the 2nd of July rather than the 4th. The story actually needs to be put in context a little bit to understand how the 2nd came to be that day. Ever since the mid-1760s, when the colonists found themselves in the wrong way with Parliament, there had been disputes and finally the calling of a Continental Congress and various questions and pleas both ways, seeking to find some resolution to the constitutional crisis that was plaguing the empire. And what finally became clear to many, especially the more radical faction that grew to the ascendancy in the first half of 1776, was that the colonies needed to unite for the purpose of separation from the British crown. And it was at a meeting, actually in early June, the 7th of June, when one of the delegates to the Continental Congress, Richard Henry Lee, rose and put forward a resolution that we historians sometimes call the Resolution of Independence. And what he did was he spoke, and this actual language is in the very end of the document. He proposed before the Continental Congress that these united colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states and absolved from allegiance to the British crown. Well, there was a resolution, therefore, on the table that the Continental Congress had to vote up or down. They weren't prepared to vote on it that day. In fact, they adjourned and they took the conversation up, and over the course of the rest of June and into the very beginning of July, they pushed and pulled on this, and finally it came to a vote. And the day in which they actually voted on Richard Henry Lee's resolution, actually he had put forward three resolutions back on June 7th having to do with the plans for what to do if we should sever from Great Britain. The vote was taken on July 2nd. And so the actual act of the Continental Congress speaking on behalf of the colonists, formally declaring their independence, took place on the 2nd, and John Adams, almost euphoric, the next day, July 3rd, wrote a letter to his wife, Abigail, in which he did say that this day, the second day of July, his actual words were that it would be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. And then he went on in a very prescient way to say it ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of the continent to the other from this time forward forevermore. So he was right historically, because the second is when we declared independence. And that's, you know, he was surprised actually when 1 year later in 1777 they got around to celebrating on the 4th.
So how come the 4th gets the attention then?
Well, if we back up just to back to June again, when Richard Henry Lee had put forward his resolution on the 7th of June 1776, there were one of the sort of stalling techniques, but it was a prudent measure, I think, was to say, well, if we're going to declare ourselves independent, we ought to have a clear rationale and statement for why we're doing it and what our reasons are. And so a couple of days, 3 days later, I think it was the 10th of June, the Continental Congress voted to appoint a committee, which they finally officially appointed the next day on the 11th of June. And it was a drafting committee of five men: Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Roger Sherman, and Robert Livingston. These five men were called upon to draft a resolution that would explain and defend the Richard Henry Lee's resolution. Well, it was this draft that these five men worked up. The principal draftsman was Thomas Jefferson, that would become the document we call the Declaration of Independence. Well, they worked on this, Jefferson worked on it for a couple of weeks, then showed it to the committee, and they scratched some things out and changed some words here and there. And then finally, there at the very beginning of July, Just as they voted on Richard Henry Lee's resolution, the Continental Congress said, well, we better look at that thing we ask you guys to write up in defense of what we've done and what we're doing. And so the Continental Congress then took up Jefferson's document, and they crossed out a whole lot of it. In fact, it's Jefferson, in some respects, went off into a summer-long funk after he saw what they did to his document, because they they crossed out nearly a third of it, or at least maybe a quarter, and changed some of the language. And they did this very quickly on the first few days of July, and most intensely on the 3rd of July. And finally, they had a draft that they were willing to generally agree on the 4th of July, that this would be the document that would explain and justify what they had done 2 days earlier. So what historians have long recognized is that the Declaration of Independence, at least the document we call that, really is not the Declaration of Independence. It is instead a formal justification of an act that was accomplished 2 days earlier. But it is worse. It's even trickier than that, because they don't go on to finally sign the engrossed parchment copy until over a month later, in the second week of August. So the document is a kind of a messy thing, and the 4th of July is just the date that this one piece of paper happened to get its first official form.
But it just wouldn't have the same panache if we called it all these years later the Explanation of Independence instead of the Declaration.
Well, that's probably true, but that's much more accurate in terms of what it probably is.
Well, we're going to talk about what this document says on the other side of this break. Just what exactly does the document set forth? And I suspect that most of us have heard a lot of that paragraph that I quoted right at the top of the show. We might not know so much about how the document goes on. Although, in some ways, the real dynamite was in those first few words. We're talking about the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution more generally with Dr. Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, and we'll be right back.
God's Word is filled with paradoxes. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July provides lenses to evaluate and bring clarity to these paradoxes. It's titled, Faith That Sees Through the Culture. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Faith That Sees Through the Culture, 1-800-325-3040.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Looking for a faithful Lutheran church in East Central Oklahoma? Welcome to Trinity Okmulgee, a friendly and faithful LCMS congregation only 40 miles south of Tulsa. Hi, this is Pastor Chris Teebs. Check us out at trinityokmulgee.org. That's Trinity, OKMULGEE, all one word, .org. See you soon at Trinity Okmulgee, Oklahoma.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. EdGruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at EdGruesome.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Ken Sherb for the sun-drenched Todd Wilkin on Issues Etc. this afternoon, July 1st. We're talking about the 2nd of July and the 4th of July and other events that happened in 1776 with Dr. Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College. Dr. Kaltoff, just one more thing to kind of set the context of this whole thing before we plunge into the actual wording of the declaration. We just need to be clear. The shooting war had already started by this time.
Oh, yes, it had. Lexington and Concord had happened in 1775. So this was they were at war, and this was not a question of whether some fighting might begin. Men had already lost their lives, and this was a struggle underway.
Now, how is the Declaration of Independence structured? I mean, it is supposed to be, in effect, a list of complaints against the king and against Parliament, and it certainly includes that. I think that's the part that we're maybe not so familiar with. Why don't you walk us through the way this thing works?
Well, the way the Declaration works in its broadest sense is as a, in logical terms, logicians call it a deductive syllogism. It's a simple syllogism in the form that was says something like this. A implies B. A, therefore, B. And this is what emerges as the grand structure of the whole document. But in order to understand how that syllogistic framework comes together, we have to see that it really has within it probably four parts. It has a preamble that essentially sets up what is going on here and declares what they're about. Namely, a decent respect to the opinion of mankind requires we should declare the causes which impel them to their separation. So the word declare is a declaration of causes, the declaration of the things that are impelling us to separate from Great Britain. The second part, as you've noted, perhaps the most famous portion, is the long second paragraph that sets out the basic political philosophy of the Declaration, if we might say that. Much of what is written in that second paragraph has been seized upon in subsequent years by historians and Americans as a key statement of American self-understanding and self-identity. The interesting thing about it, however, is that in so many respects, it was boilerplate stuff of the day. It wasn't unique. It wasn't meant to be original. In fact, when asked to reflect upon it nearly 50 years later, Thomas Jefferson famously said in 1825 that the purpose of the Declaration, the object, was not to find out new principles or new arguments never before thought of, not merely to say things that had never been said before, but to place before mankind the common sense of the subject in terms so plain and firm as to command their assent. And he went on to say that all its authority rests on the harmonizing sentiments of the day, whether expressed in conversation, letters, printed essays, or in the elementary books of public right, such as Aristotle, Cicero, Locke, Sidney. In other words, the common sense of the common American. And so most Americans probably didn't, in 1776, dwell at great length on the second paragraph. In fact, they probably read with much more scrupulous care the middle part that you suggested we might more often ignore today. And this is the long laundry list of charges, as they're called, against King George, all conspiring to make him look like the tyrant. There's a long list of 18 charges. And we can talk about some of those if you wish. But then the final of the four parts of the Declaration is sort of the conclusion, saying we've had this tyrannical rule established over us. What's left to be done is to tell the world that we are appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, and we're declaring ourselves free and independent states. So in the broadest sense, that's what the Declaration is. An introduction saying we're going to declare the causes. You'll find a list somewhere in here. Secondly, a philosophy of government that you get in the second paragraph that's so famous. Then a list of 18 charges against the king. And then finally a conclusion followed by the signatures. So that's the overall structure of the document.
So the complaints against the king are documenting that long train of offenses and usurpations that was talked about in the second paragraph. And when you have that, the conclusion is we have the right, we have the duty to throw off this government of Great Britain and to provide new guards for the future security.
That's the general argument. Effectively, what the second paragraph says, and we can look through the specifics if you care to, but the general framework is governments have a job. If they do their job, which is to secure rights, all is well. If they fail to secure rights, then we have the right to alter or abolish that government. The king has failed to secure our rights. In fact, he's become a tyrant. Therefore, we have the right to alter or abolish our relationship with Great Britain. And what we find here in that first paragraph especially is a key statement about what these people held to be self-evident. In fact, that second paragraph begins, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Now, some people have said, well, gee, this is odd. If these truths are self-evident, they must be self-evident to anybody, because that's what it means to be self-evident. But the key two words are the first two words here, "we hold." We hold these truths to be self-evident. What this really, I think, means is that it can be read to say, our political culture is saturated with such a view of the world and of things that to those who are in our culture, we American colonists now, these things appear to us to be self-evident. They may not to you, they may not to everyone else, but to us, we're telling you what American colonial thought is like. We tend to hold these things as obvious, and if you don't, we might understand that, but that's sort of where we're coming from. And so, we hold these truths to be self-evident is the opening line of this political philosophy that then enumerates five such truths. And it's in this context that we encounter a number of important phrases that have been seized upon and constructed in a variety of ways by Americans since this time. The first of these is that all men are created equal. One should look at that phrase not focusing on the word equal right off the bat, but the fact that all men are created. This is, in some respects, a recognition of what will come in the second truth, namely, that they are endowed by their creator. This notion that human beings are creatures made by a creator is one of the four identifications of the divinity in the Declaration of Independence. We have all men created by a creator, who is the one who has given them whatever rights they may claim. We can talk about rights a little bit later if you wish. But what we really are pointing to is this term creator, which is the second of the four mentions of God in the Declaration. In fact, we perhaps should back up to the first paragraph real quickly to notice that in that it talks about the laws of nature and of nature's God. So God is the God of nature, but he's also a God who gives a nature that is orderly and lawlike. Indeed, God is a legislator. He is a lawgiver, and he's the orderer of nature. And that naturally follows to the second mentioning that all men are created, and there's a creator who has endowed them with rights, that this God who gives rights is a creator, and that he is also the legislator of all of nature. Now, if we look clearly at the political philosophy of the second paragraph, what we really get here is a statement of five brief truths, that all men are created equal. Does this mean all men? Or does this mean that some men are created equal to others? Well, the way to look at this is to suggest, I would recommend, back to the very first paragraph of the Declaration, when it says it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with an other. Throughout the period leading up to the Declaration, the colonists have regarded themselves as British subjects, equal to British subjects, as if they had been in the realm. This suggestion that all men are created equal really is a political statement that says all British subjects in the North American colonies are British subjects just as if they had been British subjects in the realm of Great Britain. Okay. But when we does that follow? So then, what we find is that this isn't necessarily understood at the time as a statement that all men are exactly equal to all other men and women and so and children and people of different races. There was, of course, with slavery at the time. But the Declaration only would much later, in the hands of people like Abraham Lincoln, become a tool for this kind of broad egalitarian sentiment. what we see in the second truth is that this God has given certain unalienable rights. This rights language was a strange departure at the time, because rights had been talked about, but they had always been talked about in relation to correlative duties. Rights were given to people so they could discharge their duties. There was no such thing as a right unhinged from a duty in most colonial minds. But now the Declaration started talking about unalienable rights that somehow weren't necessarily connected to duties. This was fairly radical language, and this is the radical turn that the Declaration was taking from some of the earlier statements that the Continental Congress and state papers had made.
Let's pick it up on the other side of the break with that point about the radicality of this and this talking about rights, the rights that are, according to the Declaration, there by endowment of a creator and legislator, as Dr. Kaltoff points out, for the whole world, namely God. And we'll talk more about the Declaration of Independence and its relationship to Christian orthodoxy, and some other things about the American Revolution before we're all done with this hour. I'm Ken Sherb for Todd Wilkin on Issues Etc. We'll be right back.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Our Savior Lutheran, Westminster, Massachusetts. Redeemer Lutheran, Fairhope, Alabama. St. Matthew Lutheran, Stony Plain, Alberta, Canada. Holy Cross Lutheran, Moline, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Munster, Indiana. St. John Lutheran, Racine, Wisconsin. Calvary Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Reformation Lutheran, Afton, Missouri. Emmanuel Lutheran, Lima, Ohio. Risen Lord Lutheran, Taylorsville, Kentucky, Prince of Peace Lutheran, Crystal Lake, Illinois, and Trinity Lutheran, Elmore, Ohio. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes a congregational sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal, the Issues Etc. 300.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship. lcms.org/stewardship.
Ken Sherb for Todd Wilkin on Issues Etc. Tuesday, July 1st is today, and we're happy you are where you are listening to us. Todd is in Florida, talking to a bunch of Lutheran youth at a conference down there. We are talking with Dr. Mark Kaltoff from Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, about the Declaration of Independence, appropriate for this first week in July. By the way, in about half an hour from now, coming up just out of the break at the top of the hour, we're going to have Dr. Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about yesterday's Supreme Court decision in the so-called Hobby Lobby case. The Supreme Court's ruling, in some senses, against the Health and Human Services contraception mandate, and so that'll be coming up very soon. If you want to get in on our conversation now or later, our telephone number, 1-877-623-MYIE. That's 1-877-623-6943. You can email us, talkback@issuesetc.org is the address. Again, talkback@issuesetc.org, or send us a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Kaltoff, you were in the midst of kind of parsing that all-important second rationale paragraph, as it were, in the Declaration of Independence, and we had to kind of go to the break right in the middle of that. If you care to pick up where you left off, by all means.
Well, briefly, it says we hold these truths to be self-evident, and there are five self-evident truths, supposedly, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed with unalienable rights, that among those rights are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And then importantly, when it comes to politics, the last two statements, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted. So the purpose of government is a limited purpose. The Declaration seems to suggest a political philosophy that says government isn't to be all expansive and do everything. It has a limited job of securing a set of enumerated rights. But it could be that when given powers to secure those rights, governments might abuse them. And so the fifth self-evident truth is that if a government becomes destructive of these ends, that is, it fails to do what it's supposed to do, the people have a right to alter or abolish it. So this is a brief statement of the justification that is given. And the, in terms of historical context, the most important thing is to realize the language here is abstract, and it's as if the colonists are no longer appealing to Great Britain. They're appealing to a wider world. And, of course, they say this explicitly. They're submitting their facts to a candid world. They're suggesting that they should declare the causes to the powers of the earth. So you don't see this set in the language of appealing to Parliament or British subjects. In fact, you don't see those words anywhere in the Declaration. You see this generic rational kind of statement of political philosophy meant to appeal to those foreign nations who might be friendly to the revolutionary cause, like France.
It is a rational statement, as you say, and that gets me back to this point I made before the break and kind of teasing what we were going to talk about now. The reference to the Creator who endows us with rights, the reference to nature's God. Some people look at that, they look at it now, and they say, well, that's a reference to the Christian God. Is that what it was at the time?
Well, that's an excellent question, and there are a couple of ways that we might attempt to answer. One is by looking at all the references to the divinity in the Declaration, and then the other is to abstract from the context of the 1770s, what were people thinking when they used God language like this publicly, and what kind of people were using it? So to the first part, God is mentioned four times in the Declaration of Independence. He's mentioned in the first paragraph when we refer to the laws of nature and of nature's God. He's mentioned in the second paragraph as the Creator. And in the final paragraph, he's mentioned twice when he is called the Supreme Judge of the world, to whom they're appealing for the rectitude of their intentions. And they also conclude by saying that they are giving a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, capital P. So what we have is four different kinds of names for God here, and they certainly are consistent with a Christian understanding of God in this sense. The Christians affirm a God who is a creator. They affirm a God who is a lawgiver. They affirm a God to whom we can appeal and who calls himself a judge. And they affirmed also a God who cares for the affairs of man and exercises the kind of provident fatherly protection on whom we could rely. Now, this, of course, is not an exhaustive lexicon of the Christian understanding of the divinity, and it could be embraced by those who have non-Christian theological convictions. There are some political philosophers who have really worked hard to show how this is ultimately a political statement. If you look closely at those four namings of God, you see God is a legislator. You see also that God is the supreme judge of the world. And you see also that as the executor of provident protection, he's the one who carries out his will as an executive. So some have said, look what you see here. You have a God who exercises both executive, legislative, and judicial functions, and it's only God who can do those things without being tyrannical. And in this list of charges, what you have is some have grouped the charges against King George as a statement of ways in which he has violated legislative, executive, and judicial prerogatives of the colonists, and therefore has arrogated unto himself only powers that God should wield, and therefore he's a tyrant. Now, I have no reason to understand from any history I've studied that the founders who wrote this document thought of those references to God in that complicated way, but there are lots of ways that we could push and pull on them. It's also the case that some have emphasized one of these namings of God. For example, the laws of nature and of nature's God sounds eminently like a kind of Enlightenment deistic kind of reference to the deity, and if somebody would take that and run with it, they might suggest that the Declaration is not only not a Christian document, but an anti-Christian document. But to do that, one would have to ignore the other references to God. I think principally the document is an international legal brief that's not seeking to say a whole lot explicitly about the nature of God, but what it says isn't inconsistent with a Christian understanding, and this is largely because of the broader context. Most of the people who were American colonists at the time were church-going people. Most of them self-identified as Christians. Many were imbued of a Reformed Protestant theology. They were committed to a kind of localist, churchly life, and they imbibed deeply in a kind of theology of the national covenant, a belief that somehow or another they stood in a close relationship with God, and that the war that had recently been visited upon them was somehow a punishment for their sins, and that they needed to recognize God's overruling providence, acknowledge their sins, confess, repent, look for deliverance by placing themselves back within the covering of God's protective hand. This, of course, doesn't come from the Declaration, but what we do see is the Continental Congress issuing many fast day and proclamations, calls for fasting, prayer, and humiliation, some of them explicitly in the name of Jesus Christ. So we have a culture that is, if not overtly Christian in something like the Declaration of Independence, it is, as one of my colleagues in the history department here at Hillsdale used to like to say, the fabric of the American culture was stitched together with Christian thread. That means there's this thread of Christianity running through, but that may not be enough to say that, some people like to say, that all the founders were Christians or that we were a Christian nation.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, I've got a little bit of a text here from March 1776, just a few months before the Declaration of Independence, a call by the Continental Congress for national repentance. It says we should confess and bewail our manifold sins and transgression, and by a sincere repentance and amendment of life, appease his, that is God's, righteous displeasure, and through the merits and mediation of Jesus Christ, obtain his pardon and forgiveness. Now, that's a pretty explicitly Christian statement, or Christian kind of statement. Let me just press you one more time on this, Dr. Kaldoff. Why don't you find that kind of language in the Declaration?
Well, I think we have to, whenever I talk with my students, we read a lot of these primary texts. And by the way, that proclamation you just read was the very one I had in mind. who is the audience? A key thing in reading any text, who is the audience and what are we trying to move them? The proclamation that you just read was one addressed by colonial representatives in the Continental Congress to the home front, to the colonists themselves, to the soldiers on the battlefield to amend their ways, that we need to get in the line with God's ways here. The Declaration of Independence is, again, submitting these facts to a candid world, and it essentially says we have a decent respect to the opinions of mankind, and so we're going to tell them why we're doing this. And what is these United Colonies are doing, they're assuming among the powers of the earth the separate and equal stations that they're entitled. So think of it this way. If you've got a variety of different powers of the earth, you've got France, you have Germany, you have Spain, you have Great Britain, and the list goes on. These are the various powers of the earth, and the colonists are essentially saying, we as a people are no longer British subjects. We are separating and joining those separate powers of the earth. Well, you're probably going to speak to those varied powers of the earth with different language than you would if you were talking to your home front, who had a kind of cultural and religious homogeneity.
So there's a recognition of God in the Declaration, a reference to God. We're going to talk after this break about how various religious groups kind of thought of that as the fighting continued in the American Revolution. We'll be right back.
Whether you're a man yourself or a woman who cares about the men in your life, you won't want to miss the June issue of The Lutheran Witness. Join John Kleinig, Hans Feeney, Jeffrey Hemmer, Broer Erickson, and others in this power-packed issue on men at church as they explore toxic masculinity, godly fatherhood, the religious gender gap, and more. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Thanks to generous supporters, tuition for all incoming residential pastoral ministry and deaconess students at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, will be paid in full. Hi, this is Dr. Lawrence Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary. Learn more about studying for the vocations of pastor or deaconess in the 2018-19 academic year at ctsfw.edu.
Lutheranism in the public square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you ever wanted to better understand philosophy and its impact on your family, your church, or your world, but didn't know where to begin? Concordia University, Wisconsin has an innovative, free online course for you entitled Philosophy Kata Christan. These six engaging video sessions are taught by noted Lutheran philosopher, lecturer, author, and pastor, Dr. Gregory Scholz. Learn more by clicking the Kata Christan logo at issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Coming up next hour, in fact, about a half hour from now, we will be talking about a theologian that Lutherans in America, and certainly Christians in America, owe a great deal to, although you may not know a lot about him. Francis Pieper, who was a writer as well as a professor, a seminary president, a synodical president. We'll be talking with Dr. John Woolraby about Francis Pieper coming up in about half an hour here on Issues Etc. Got about 10 minutes more now with Dr. Mark Kaltoff from Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. And we are talking right now about the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution. And let's get a little to that revolution now, Dr. Kaltoff. You have this declaration that comes early on. The fighting has already started, as we've pointed out, by the time the declaration is made. But early on in the going, there is this declaration that talks about nature and nature's God and all the other things we've mentioned by way of references to the deity. And for Christians, there is going to be a certain issue here when you run across biblical texts like Romans 13 that call upon people to be subject to the governing authorities. How did various Christians kind of square that with the whole idea of revolution? I suppose we could start in the obvious place and say, well, how did the Anglicans think about revolution? But maybe it's not so obvious, because there were at least Anglican lay people who were in favor of the revolution. Is that not right?
Oh, my, yes. We have to keep in mind that if we look at the period 1775, 1776, and we would go through and count heads, we would find that the Anglicans were, of course, predictably the largest denominational identity in the colonists, over a million. And there were just over between 3 and 3.5 million colonists at the time of the Revolution. And so you've got over a million Anglicans. So clearly many of the patriots had to be numbered among them. And many of the loyalists, of course, who fled back to the mother country were Anglicans as well. But you had over 500,000 Congregationalists. You had 410,000 or so Presbyterians, a good number of Dutch Reformed. Interestingly, only about 25,000 Baptists, and German churches of some type were probably about 250,000. Catholics also were a very small number, but Anglicans were a very large body, so many of them were able to square this without much difficulty. I think an important point to make to begin this is that one of the things about American culture at this time, and I don't think this is an exaggeration to say that it was in some sense almost Bible-drenched. The Bible, as the sociologist Robert Bella used to like to say about, 40 years ago, the Bible was the one book that Americans in the 17th and 18th centuries could be expected to know well. Biblical imagery was sort of the framework for public discourse, imaginative thought. People knew their Bibles. They picked up imagery all the time from it. For example, when we had declared independence, and among the ruminations of the early founders was to come up with a seal, a symbol for this new country. Ironically, it was Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson who proposed a picture of a seal that had the words around the outside that said, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God," and then had a picture of Moses leading the Israelites through the parted Red Sea with Pharaoh's chariots chasing them along. It was a conscious image to appeal to biblically literate Americans, which meant most of them, that Americans were to understand themselves as doing what the ancient Israelites had done. Some of them even referred to themselves as God's new Israel here. The point was, there were certain kinds of governors who were themselves not legitimate ministers of God in the sense of Romans 13. One of the best expositions of this was a sermon widely published throughout the Patriot colonies in 1776. There was a clergyman, a very influential New England clergyman, had been educated at Harvard, but has spent his career in the pulpit, named Samuel West. And he preached to the legislature a sermon on May 29th of 1776, so literally about a week before Richard Henry Lee's resolution. The title of his sermon was "On the Right to Rebel Against Governors." Now, a Harvard-educated clergyman is, of course, going to know the Book of Romans, and he quoted at full length Romans 13, 1 through 6, and he then paused and said, after reading the text, "A very little attention will be sufficient to show that this text is so far from favoring arbitrary government that, on the contrary, it strongly holds forth the principles of true liberty." And then he goes on for some time in the sermon, pointing out that Romans 13 is an injunction for people to submit to legitimately constituted authority. And when that legitimately constituted authority turns itself into a criminal activity, undermining the very liberties of people properly given by God, that it also relinquishes them from obeying God. Now, my point isn't to defend Samuel West's exegesis of Romans 13, but it is to suggest that the American patriots who held swords in one hand often had Bibles in the others. They knew their Pauline epistles, and they understood about biblical injunctions, and they simply found that Paul's teaching did not apply in the sense of requiring them to submit to the tyrannical rule that they understood Great Britain was imposing upon them.
Now, there's another famous sermon, and it had been addressed, perhaps, made by Jonathan Mayhew from, what, about 1750, that people still continued to talk about 25 and more years later. It was a speech marking the centennial, really, of Charles I's beheading, which gave, I think, a similar kind of take to the one you're talking about.
Yeah, I think you're right. Mayhew was earlier, and his sermon was published as a tract. I think it was from roughly around the 1760s, maybe, that it was finally published. But the sermon on the execution of Charles I was delivered in 1750, and I think it was called something like A Discourse Concerning Unlimited Submission. And he was talking about the resistance to a tyrant was a glorious Christian duty. And therefore, it's not so much that we have this right to resist tyrants, but at some point it becomes a Christian obligation to overthrow those who are ministers of evil. This, of course, is a long question in the history of Western civilization's debates about political culture. Is it the job of Christians to submit to ungodly government regardless? And the American Revolution can be seen as one more installation in that centuries-long conversation.
Well, and Mayhew raises the question of the use of reason in this, because he leans a lot on saying, well, a rational person knows you're not supposed to submit to a dictatorial or tyrannical government. How did Lutherans come out on this? Maybe the Muhlenberg family is a good test case for us, because you've got Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, the so-called father of Lutheranism in America, who, for the most part, enjoined his parishioners, although he didn't urge it very strongly, to obey the king and to go along with the revolution. But he had a son, famously, who unveiled his uniform as a soldier in the Continental Army right after church, and he went off to war.
Right, and I think that shows, in some respects, what might be regarded as the Lutheran ambivalence on this question. The Lutherans did not have a prominent place in the American Revolution, in part because their numbers were very small. In fact, in 1700, there were only seven Lutheran churches in North America, to my counting. And although that had grown to nearly 250 by the Revolutionary period, you just didn't have quite the numbers that were there to make a generalization that would be meaningful. But I think that this example that you give is speaks well to the fact that a simple sort of hard Augustinian two-kingdom theology that says, I don't have any possible responsibility here. I'm just a pilgrim passing through, and if the government's bad, so much the worse. That didn't have complete purchase on all Lutherans, who were, some of whom, like you point out, were willing to fight.
At the National Archives to this day, the Constitution of the United States and the Declaration of Independence are side by side. I'll give you about a minute, Dr. Kaltoff. Is that appropriate? Or, as a lot of people say, do those two documents almost combust when they come into contact with one another?
Well, this is a point of discussion among political philosophers and historians. There are some schools of political philosophy that have gone to great length to argue that the Declaration and the Constitution fit together famously, as Abraham Lincoln would later say, like apples of gold in a picture of silver. And yet there are others who suggest that the Declaration of Independence says nothing explicit about a form of government. It says that people may put together any form as they think shall most fully affect their happiness. And this means it could be any number of forms of government. It's I think, would be difficult to say that the Constitution is antithetical wholly to the Declaration, but I also would say the Declaration isn't so prescriptive that it requires that the U.S. Constitution be the only frame of government that might grow out of it.
So, Dr. Mark Kaltoff, how do you intend to commemorate the Declaration of Independence this July 4th?
Well, it just so happens that I have some family that I don't get to see as regularly as I would like, and there's been sort of a spontaneous small reunion gathering about an hour and a half from here at a family member's home. So we're probably going to do a little bit of what John Adams recommended we should be doing tomorrow.
On the 2nd of July.
But we'll probably be doing it Friday still.
All right.
But
Dr.
he recommended
Mark Kaltoff. Dr. Mark Kaltoff from Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan. Next hour, right off, we've got Dr. Matt Harrison from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, president of the Synod, to talk to us about the Health and Human Services mandate and the Supreme Court decision. And then Dr. John Woolrobby talking about Francis Pieper. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.